Family Ann are at a lecture demonstration of the advanced techniques of solitaire with Mr. Wobbern, the old man they adopted from the welfare department.
Ask yourself, am I playing with a full deck?
Am I playing with a full deck?
Does anyone here ever cheat at solitaire?
Dr. Flirtley, I'd like to respond to that.
Mr. Wobbern, sit down. You don't have to confess.
You're not a cheater, Mr. Wobbern.
He's an old man. He doesn't know what he's saying.
Cool it, Charles.
Well, you don't want to lose your welfare benefits, do you?
Oh, don't worry about my benefits, Charles.
Mr. Wobbern,
it's all right, Emily.
Let us hear from Mr. Wobbern, one of the world's greatest solitaire players.
Who do we cheat if we cheat at solitaire? And if we cheat, why do we cheat? And when do we cheat?
He never cheats at solitaire. I've watched him for hours.
Please sit down. We are having a transcendental moment.
Sit down, Charles. Right. Transcendental moment.
Okay. Please continue, Mr. Wobbern.
If your aces are out, but your deuces are buried, and you're nearing the end of play, why not try laying a red 7 on a red 8? You might find out something important.
If there are any officials here tonight from the welfare department, I'd just like to point out that Mr. Wobbern doesn't know what he's saying.
You've been warned not to interrupt.
Who do you cheat if you cheat at solitaire?
You cheat yourself, Mr. Wobbern.
No, Charles. At solitaire, you cheat yourself if you don't cheat.
With Janet Coleman, David Dozer, Jim Freund, Simon Lokley, and Peter Zanger. Is written by David Dozer, directed by Anarchy. Radio technique by Peter Zanger. This program is produced in the United States of America.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI in New York. It's 10 o'clock Wednesday night. Time for Off the Hook. Good evening, everybody. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. The program is Off the Hook, where we congregate every week to talk about the latest in the net, internet, and telephone systems, and various other high-tech gizmos that are out there, and what's going on with them, how they affect you, and of course, we have the opportunity to communicate amongst ourselves in various ways. Well, it's been a busy couple of weeks here at BAI. It's amazing what people getting together can do. We raised, according to this little calculator that's being transmitted on the camera here, $820,000. $820,301. Some wise guy pledged a buck. That's great. That's I think more than we've ever raised before. It's almost $1 million. Can you believe that? Wow. So, we've gathered a few people here tonight just to say thanks. No, they left the phone off the hook. Let's try over
thank
here.
You.
There we are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Un millón de gracias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Komapsumnida.
Thank you very much.
Why, thank you.
Merci.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. That's only a few of us here at WBAI saying thanks for all the help for getting us to where we are now. And please, if you did pledge, pay your pledge. If you get a little reminder from us in the next couple of days, please send us a check to the appropriate address, and we'll be here for a long time to come. Wow, I'm really heartened to see that, to hear how people support this radio station. Hey, there could be 100 Newt Gingriches out there, but I think we're going to survive if we all stick together. Yeah, this is Off the Hook, and we've got a lot of special things to talk about today, including a bit of a crisis that will affect just about everybody, might have already affected everybody. You don't know. You don't know until it's happened. It may have already happened. We'll be speaking about that in case you didn't read the newspapers. Well, y'all know what we're talking about when we get to it. Here's a little funny news item which showed up on the internet. This was posted to All 2600. This guy was apparently watching his TV set. And what he does, what a lot of us do, is even though he doesn't need it, watches the closed captioning on TV. You ever do that? You ever watch closed captioning? It's kind of funny to see all the words that they miss. You know, sometimes they miss entire bits of dialogue. And sometimes the words don't even reflect anything at all what people are saying. But in this particular case, the person was watching it and it was live. In other words, somebody was actually typing it in while the person on the TV set was talking. And so the person was watching this on the bottom of the TV screen, and all of a sudden, the scrolling that you get, you know, line to line scrolling, stopped, and the caption said, "No carrier." Of course, those of you with computer modems know what that means. That means the phone got hung up somehow. And then about 45 seconds later, it said, "Ring." Meaning the incoming phone line was ringing, then connect, and then the scrolling started all over again. So apparently, the person was connected somehow on a computer. They lost their connection, and they had to call back, and that's how the whole thing works. Now imagine if we had beaten them to it, if we knew the phone number and we called in there. I don't know if they need a password or anything like that, but you could just type whatever you want over these closed captioning. That's something to investigate a little further. Anyone has any information on that, they know how to reach us. All right, those of you that, for whatever reason, and we won't pry, but those of you who subscribe to Wired may have seen a letter in there by me. Well, okay, yes and no. Yes, I did write a letter to Wired, and no, I didn't quite write what they said, or at least I wrote a whole lot more than what they said. So what we have tonight, we have a very special presentation for you. We have rented at great expense and an awful lot of trouble. The voice of Wired. The voice of Wired is here. Does the voice of Wired have a microphone working?
I hope so.
Okay, that is the voice of Wired. Whenever you see Wired out there on the newsstands, associate that voice with it, because that is the official voice of Wired. Don't try using that voice without permission of Wired, or you'll get sued. And if you have a voice similar to that, you'd better go in for some surgery or something to change the tones. Okay, enough said about that. What we're going to do here, and this is just for the benefit of those people that have read the letter and think that I didn't really come down hard enough on that blockhead that wrote the article a couple of months ago about the Hackers on Planet Earth conference. He basically said that the conference was lame. The conference was filled with people that didn't really know what they were doing, and various other insults like that, and he said some personal things too, and I just sort of felt that someone had to set the record straight, and I was happy to hear that they were going to print this letter setting the record straight, but what happened instead was they printed what you'd call highlights of the letter, and they weren't even that. They were basically just the beginning and the end, and maybe a sentence or two in the middle. So what we're going to do is we're going to have the official voice of Wired read the letter as it appeared there, and then I'm just going to hop in whenever there's a gap and fill it in with what I really said. So take it away, Voice of Wired, starting from the top.
The article or letter is Hack the Hope. At first glance, Charles Platt's review of the Hackers on Planet Earth Hope Conference Hackers, Threat or Menace, in issue Wired 2.11, page 82, appears to be a parody of itself. Here is an article that makes fun of journalists attending the conference searching unsuccessfully for criminals, is written by a journalist doing just the same, and ends up with genuine disappointment at not finding any crime.
Now, if I could just butt in there for a second, Ms. Wired, I sort of phrased that a little differently. I said, here is an article that makes fun of journalists attending the conference searching unsuccessfully for criminals that is written by someone who is genuinely disappointed at not finding any crime. I don't know, I just felt that sentence sort of rolled a little better. But you guys, you know, if you, that's how you want to do it, fine, rewrite it. First of all, you called them a journalist, and I didn't go that far, but who cares? Okay, I'm sorry.
It doesn't take long to realize that Platt takes his judgmental little discourse very seriously, however.
I didn't put a however there, but okay.
Like so many before him who have attempted to cover the hacker world, he just doesn't get it.
All right, I have to butt in now because there's a couple of things I believe you left out. Now I'm going to fill that in right here. Be patient there. Platt is perplexed by the fact that hackers are trusting individuals who are open to diverse opinions, such as those set forth by former CIA operative Robert Steele. Only a very limited and narrow view of this segment of society would result in Platt's righteous indignation that we don't act like the criminals he imagines us to be. Perhaps 10 years ago, this Geraldo outlook would have been understandable, but now that we're halfway through the 90s, the readers of Wired deserve a bit more than the chance to watch Charles Platt discover what color the sky is. The article is filled with hints of things being not quite right in the hacker world, although Platt can never seem to put any of his fingers directly upon the problem. Is it the material we publish in 2600? Platt seems to disapprove of our motives, saying that we print, quote, a lot more answers than questions, unquote. And that my, quote, air of innocence doesn't jibe with the attitude and content, unquote, of the magazine. As a forum for hackers, it wouldn't be quite right if we stopped in our tracks every time there was a chance of someone's moral sensibilities being offended. And so we answer as many questions as we can. As for my having an air of innocence, I suppose I have one because I don't feel guilty of anything, despite Platt's crazy allegation that I'm constantly looking over my shoulder, expecting to be arrested at any moment. If I was really doing that, then it would sort of deflate the air of innocence accusation now, wouldn't it? It's rare to be condemned for being guilty and innocent at the same time, but in this article, nothing short of an accurate fact would surprise me.
Platt strongly implies that 2600 corrupts people by providing a forum for hackers, an accusation I find offensive and typical of those sensationalist reporters who will concoct any fact to sell a story. 2600 provides a vital service to people who are curious. It disseminates obscure information.
Okay, I have to butt in again because that's all that Wired printed, but there's a bit more that you guys didn't print. As well as a means of disseminating information for people who wouldn't be able to reach an audience otherwise. Kind of like that sentence that wasn't able to reach an audience. Referring to our meetings as 2600 franchises is the same height of stupidity that the federal government resorts to when they accuse us of engaging in conspiracies at each and every one of our get-togethers. If Platt had bothered to do some research, he would have found that these franchises are loosely knit groups of people throughout the world who share a common interest. It's got nothing to do with profit, big business, or the growth industry that Platt defines us as being. On a personal level, Platt seems especially enthralled by the fact that I use more than one name. He latches onto this fact as if it's the evidence he needs to prove the point he never makes. Even the subtitle of the article, Wired Discovers Who Emmanuel Goldstein Really Is, points to the importance of this, quote, revelation, unquote. The fact is that I've never made my use of multiple identities a secret. I strongly believe in the right to choose whatever name suits you. What's particularly ironic here is that Platt would probably have missed this little fact if I hadn't told him about it in the first place. Too bad, Platt, you missed the real sinister subplot here. Hacker editor seeks to discredit self. Charles Platt found me to be, quote, one of the most evasive human beings, unquote, he ever attempted to interview. I am honored, but in all fairness, when one is organizing and running a conference, there isn't an abundance of time to do one-on-one interviews. We tried to accommodate Mr. Platt, an hour-long interview and answers to all of his follow-up questions, but he wanted us to focus all of our attention upon him and walk him through the entire hacker world. There were reporters from dozens of countries in attendance, even if we believe Platt's repeated assertion that his Wired article was more important and would get us tons of publicity. We didn't believe such preferential treatment was fair to anybody. Wired people requested and received more free passes to Hope than any other organization. It was our assumption that with 1,400 people to talk to and so many reporters, you folks would have been able to piece a semi-accurate story together. It's too bad Mr. Platt defined Hope as being very bland, lame, and devoid of subversive content. Perhaps this is why he saw fit to disrupt a lively seminar on cryptography by repeatedly shouting, "Where's the crime? We're here to see crime," while chugging a Zima. I'm completely unmoved by his dismay, because anyone with such a narrow view of the hacker world is clearly incapable of ever appreciating it. And back to you, Wired.
Of all those in attendance, the vast majority were captivated by something or someone at some time during the conference. The rather simple moral here is that if you spend all your time looking for things that don't exist, you'll wind up being very disappointed. It's too bad Wired readers were robbed of the chance to see the significance of the largest hacker event in history.
Well, okay, so that was the official voice of Wired with the official transcript of how the letter appeared in Wired, and of course my voice was the parts that did not appear. And I don't know, I guess I'll defer to them, and I guess they knew what to cut and what not to cut. I'd say they cut about 80% of it out, but that's just the nature of publishing. Anyway, I guess that's a lesson that if you read something anywhere, see it on the TV, hear it on the radio, you may not be getting the whole story. There may be more to it. So always ask questions and dig a little bit deeper. In a moment, we'll be back talking to Fiber Optic about what's going on the net. But first, this little musical break.
Too much pressure.
Well, those of you that have been reading the papers in the past couple of days may have seen some disturbing articles about the internet and about how things can be compromised in ways that seem like it's almost impossible to prevent or detect or anything. And everybody's vulnerable, and it can happen at any time. And it may have already happened, and nobody really knows what's going on. The kind of story you like to sink your teeth into, right? Well, that's just a little bit of what's been going on. We're going to get an update from Fiber Optic, who is currently joining us on the telephone. Fiber, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, and, well, since you're on the phone, you can't see what it is I'm holding up in my hands here now, can you?
I guess I can.
No, you can't. That's one of the disadvantages. But I'm holding up something, a magazine that just came out this week that names you as one of the 100 most intelligent people in New York City. Is that something
yeah,
or what?
That's really silly.
That's, boy, you're in here with such people as... As David Letterman and who else? I don't know. Oh, Michio Kaku is in here too, you know.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and Alphonse D'Amato, very, very nice company there. And Madonna. You know, it's an interesting story because I don't know if you know this, but I was in the running for this thing myself. In fact, I wound up in a sudden death playoff with Madonna. Can you believe that?
Wow.
As far as being one of the most, I actually ranked 102. Unfortunately, and they only go up to 100. But they asked Madonna these, asked me and Madonna these questions, and I don't know if they're entirely fair. One of them being, who was it who shot what's his name in Reservoir Dogs?
The guy who shot
Nice Guy Eddie. You know who shot Nice Guy Eddie? And you know, I always thought it was Mr. Pink. But she answered that no, it was Harvey Keitel. And, you know, after the competition, I was thinking, you know, Chris Penn played Nice Guy Eddie, you know, and that's sort of the brother of the guy she married. She could have found out that way that it was Harvey Keitel. It didn't seem fair. And then they asked a physics question, and I don't know if you know this, but Madonna is a physicist as well as an artist. In fact, she is, this is true, I'm not making this up, this is true. If Michio cannot do his show on Wednesday nights here, she is on the telephone list of somebody to call to substitute. And so when they asked what is the furthest planet from the sun, I, like a jerk, answered Pluto, and she knew that it was Neptune because they sort of the orbits intersect, and it happens to be one of those times when Neptune is the furthest planet, and that's why she's in there and I'm not.
So that's the reason, huh?
That's the reason, yeah. But, you know, I'm not bitter about it. I'm not bitter. Madonna could use the publicity, I think. You know, but yeah, you must be getting all kinds of admiring people following you all over the place. You being in that group of 100, you all get together for a group photo, I imagine. Hello.
Yeah.
You there?
Sorry.
Okay. Well, one of those 100 people bothering you right now, right?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Wow.
There's just smart people everywhere.
Yeah. Hey, Daniel Patrick Moynihan's in there too. I understand when you become one of these 100 people, you can call on the other 100 people at any time. It's sort of like a support group.
So it's kind of like the Fortune 100?
Uh-huh. That's really great.
Maybe
really
we could great. Have our own magazine.
Yeah.
We'll call it Fortune.
Wow. Anyway, you're stuck down there at Echo.
Yeah.
The system that never crashes, according to, according to what was it, Time Magazine?
The system that never sleeps.
Yeah. Well, it's sleeping right now, I think, right?
Well, it's back up for the time being.
Okay. And it's going to stay up?
Hopefully.
That's good. That's
it's,
good.
It's not always as cooperative as it should be.
Hey, Henry Kissinger's in this list, too. You know, I'm glad Henry made it. He was having a bit of trouble in the playoffs, too, you know. But he made it. That's good. And his occupation is international consultant.
Really?
Yeah. That's so if you need any consulting on international issues, make sure you call Hank.
Like if we wanted to, say, take a trip to Tahiti, we should...
Yeah, I imagine he knows all the restrictions, you know, the best airfares and things like that.
Hmm.
If you need consultation on anything of international, you know, customs or the best food to eat, that kind of thing.
Hmm.
What language they speak in Burma, for instance.
What language do they speak in Burma? Is it like...
I don't know.
Myanmarese or something?
I think it's Burmese, I think.
But it's not anymore.
Well, you know, I can look this up.
Yeah?
I have a computer with all this information.
Really?
Yeah. Hang on. Let me. I'll boot it up while I'm talking to you.
Okay.
Is
this one of those CIA World Factbook computers?
It's sort of like that. you know, you can't hear this machine booting up. You might hear it beep if you're lucky. But the motor is very, very quiet. Ah, there we go. There we go. Okay. Yeah, I'll look up. In fact, we'll be able to hear a bit of their national anthem too.
Really?
Which I think is really kind of neat. Of course, we're completely off the topic here, but that's just the nature. Oh, wait a minute. Apparently, I entered my password incorrectly on my own machine. How do you like that? Okay, I'm in now. Okay, so we're booting up the system, and we'll check on what language they speak in Burma. In the meantime, tell us, what's going on with the Internet?
Well, I don't know if anyone noticed, but there was a screaming headline in the New York Times fairly recently, written by John Markoff.
I noticed.
And oh, good, you noticed.
I sure did.
Well, I don't know how many other people noticed.
A lot of people noticed.
It's that crazy Internet stuff again. But actually, this time it's serious. And it turns out that this problem has always existed, and no one ever really thought that it would be taken advantage of, frankly.
Uh-huh.
But recently it has.
Uh-huh.
Has been. And the particular problem in question would allow certain malcontents and deviant characters, basically, to gain access to any connection on the Internet at all, basically hijack a connection, so to speak.
Okay, now, how could you hijack a connection on the Internet? How would you physically do it?
Well, the way that they actually do it is that every IP datagram, that's uh-huh. every packet,
uh-huh.
has a sequence number.
Okay.
And the way the sequence numbering works is that it starts at some arbitrary number that both sides of the connection are aware of, and it counts upwards by ones. This is the current packet number, this is the next packet number, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
Well, let's just say, for example, that you had some scheme by which you could guess what sequence number a certain connection out there on the net was currently in, what sequence number it was up to.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of just popped on, and you started mimicking the sequence number because you knew what it was. I don't know how much sense that really makes.
Well, okay, you're basically pretending that you're that packet of data.
Yeah, you're basically pretending that you're in sequence.
What happens to the real data, though?
The real data, assumingly, would kind of be squelched.
Uh-huh. Would it be received someplace else?
Yeah, actually, see, I haven't actually tested this myself,
uh-huh.
but I know for certain that it does work because it was done in a number of cases. Only fairly recently, over the past few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, is there a way to get this information easier, or can anybody figure out what it is, or do you have to be able to...
Actually, what happened was that there's an FTP site in Colorado called corrupt.security. Is it com or org? Security. Yeah, it's security.com, and it's security spelled with a K instead of a C.
Uh-huh.
It's you can anonymous FTP to that site, and I know that at some point in the recent past, the actual software necessary to do this was posted up there, as are usually lots of security related tools. Now, in this particular case, the code posted that allowed this to happen
mm-hmm.
was, in technical terms, a replacement for a device driver that was for Sun machines. And as we know, Sun is notorious for...
Notorious, yes.
Yeah, it's notorious. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
In terms of security. But...
Is this specifically 413, or is this...
This is just Sun in general.
Sun in general, okay.
Yeah, we're talking about SunOS, not Solaris.
Okay.
So, yeah, in practical terms, it would be Sun 413 and below.
Okay.
But it's a device driver replacement for the Internet protocol, in the way that it actually constructs datagrams.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, it allows the user to spoof datagrams. So now, before, while we had packet sniffers,
mm-hmm.
which were actually sniffing Ethernet packets,
mm-hmm. okay.
now we have basically Internet protocol spoofers, where we can literally hijack a connection and spoof Internet protocol datagrams.
Now, can a sniffer help you to become a spoofer?
No, not at all.
Okay.
We're talking about two different things, basically. The Ethernet is over your local network.
Right.
out over the net, everything is internet protocol.
Okay. What can people do to prevent this?
Actually, there is not a whole lot that can be done right now. What we're attempting to do, myself and a couple of people locally at least, is we're attempting to set up what would be called a tunneled IP network, which means that we're setting up a firewalled local network, and within that network, what we're doing is that we're authenticating all IP datagrams. And the way that we're doing that is there's a number of ways that can be accomplished. One particular way is using a piece of software known as SWIPE. That's SW, capital IP, lowercase e. What that is again, it's an internet protocol device driver replacement. What it does is that it allows you to use encryption for all IP datagrams, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might say to yourself that must be really costly and time-consuming. It must slow down the net connection a lot.
I did say that to yourself? Yes, I'm saying it to myself right now.
If everything is encrypted end-to-end?
You're going to prove me wrong?
No, actually, that is true.
Okay.
Trials that are being done at the current time by some people that I know on some local sites is not necessarily using full-blown encryption for every IP packet, but simply authenticating it by using a hash, using the MD5 hashing, MD5 being Message Digest 5, which for those of you who are unfamiliar, you might have heard of MD5 because it's used in PGP in order to generate what's called basically a footprint of your public key.
Mm-hmm.
But MD5 is a hashing algorithm that's supposed to generate a secure sequence of numbers that should not be able to be duplicated. Well, just to give you an example, a certain IP datagram should generate, when run through MD5, should generate a unique footprint that another IP datagram never could, in theory.
I see.
So, basically, what you can say is, here's the IP datagram, and the other side does an MD5 hash, and then it says, is this the footprint that we got compared with the one that we should have gotten?
Okay, but this is something that has not yet been perfected.
Right, this is something that's still in the works, basically. If we're talking about the larger global internet, everyone's at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, no exceptions.
And do you have to even use your machine to be at risk?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, let's say you don't even log on to your machine at all. Can you still be spoofed?
You can. Any open connection can be spoofed.
Uh-huh.
Basically.
So as long as you're connected to the internet in some manner.
As long as you're, say, telnetting out somewhere, as long as you have a socket connection to another machine.
Okay.
Then that connection between those two sockets, the socket on your machine and the socket on the other machine.
Right.
The traffic can be intercepted and spoofed.
Fascinating.
And I don't think people are aware of this on such a large scale that it can be done at.
Supposing you just dial into a local system and you don't telnet out anywhere.
Well, then there's nothing really to be spoofed. Then of course, the problem is worrying about being sniffed.
Uh-huh. Right, and you got to be sniffed. Okay.
Yeah. So you have a choice, either be sniffed or spoofed or both.
Okay.
But if you're making connections out over the net, then you have the potential to be spoofed.
Well, I think with all this talk of sniffing and spoofing, a lot of people are just going to opt to stand back a while and see how it all turns out. That's really something. I guess probably the best thing to do at this point would be to figure out how to do it. You know, figure out how to spoof.
And yeah.
If you're able to, show the world how it's done.
Well, the thing that people should bear in mind is the actual sequence number, if I recall, is an int, which in English terms means it's a 32-bit number,
mm-hmm.
an integer, which basically has the range of 0 to roughly 4 billion. And obviously the number is not going to be very large. It's going to be a relatively small number. At least in a number of cases I've heard of, they simply start numbering at 0.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real guesswork involved. You can guess how old the connection is, and judging by knowing that information, Say, for example, you're watching a particular socket on a foreign machine mm-hmm. that no one's connected to yet. All of a sudden, someone's connected to it. So it's a brand new connection. Do you follow?
Yes.
Obviously, the sequence number is going to be very small because
okay.
the connection is new. and sequence numbers, as the age of the connection gets higher, the sequence number gets higher.
Does that mean there's a limit on how long a connection can last?
No, not at all. In fact, well, technically, yeah, but you'd never have... I've never heard of a connection overflowing because it reached 4 billion.
Well, how long would it take to reach 4 billion?
A very, very, very long time.
Are we talking years?
Yeah. Well, what would be your estimate on overflowing a long int on sequence numbers? It just starts back at zero?
All right, recycles. Okay.
Okay.
That's what I suspected. All right, let's. We're going to open this up to the phone lines. Do you have a bit of time, Mark? You there?
Yeah, sorry.
You have a bit of time, or do you have to get back to work?
No, actually, sure. Go ahead.
Okay, first, let me just tell you that Burmese is spoken by 69% of the people in... actually, it's called Myanmar now. It's not even called Burma anymore.
Right.
And the secondary language is Karen, K-A-R-E-N, 10%. Then the Shan, Tibeto-Burman. There's a language called Mon, M-O-N. Jingpo, Mon Khmer, as in Khmer Rouge, Paruk, and they speak something called Other, 1%. Now, if you want to hear the actual national anthem here, we can do that as well. Sort of winds up like that. Here we go. Okay, I think we get the idea. That's, I assume they have better sound over there, too. Could you hear that at all, Mark?
Oh, yeah, I heard it loud and clear. In
pretty
fact,
pretty stirring, isn't it?
It brings a tear to my eye and a lump to
it
my
is.
Throat.
It is. It's called Gaba Maje Burma, which means, of course, we shall love Burma. And that is what it means. Okay, enough of that. Our phone number is 212-279-3400. You know, I can just imagine somebody tuning in right now wondering why we did that. And I won't tell if you don't tell. Okay, 212-279-3400. Good evening. You're on the radio.
Is the 9X operator? You have a collect call. Will you accept the charges?
You're not a 9X operator.
Amnex, sir. You have a collect call from Joe. Will you accept the
charges? Yeah, you're not an Amnex operator either. Come on.
Excuse me, sir?
You're not an Amnex operator, are you?
Yes, this is an Amnex operator.
Okay, where are you located?
Florida, sir.
What part of Florida?
Tampa.
Tampa, Florida?
Correct.
What's the area code in Tampa, Florida?
05.
Okay, you're an Amnex operator. Big deal. Next call. Good evening. You're on.
I had a comment on the internet problem.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I was looking up on the CERT advisory, and apparently one of the ways to get around that is to basically get your router to know that machines with one number will only send packets from one side of your network, whereas certain other numbers can only come from the other side. So the idea is if you have multiple machines that, say, are trusted and talk to each other on your local network, then you basically program your router so it knows that any kind of IP number for those machines cannot come from the outside socket of your router.
Okay, what, Mark, how would you get around that?
Well, so you're saying that how do you trust traffic on your local LAN?
Well, you would have to have a trusted things on your LAN, but this means that someone, say, outside your local LAN could not masquerade as one of your machines.
Well, okay, but let's say, for example, that someone from out on the net is telnetting to your machine and would be anyway.
Then you have a problem.
Oh, of course you do.
this fix would supposedly take care of is, say you have someone with a Macintosh or an IBM somewhere directly on an internet hookup, it keeps them from at least... Because with those machines, all you have to do is go into the driver and tell it what the IP number is, and you can masquerade as anything you want.
Right.
And that would take care of that. At least that's what, near as I can tell, from the CERT thing, and they gave a... So the defense that CERT was advising was basically to program your router to know what IP numbers should or should not come from each side.
Okay, thanks for the info.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. That doesn't really address the whole problem, though, does it, Mark?
No, actually, all it does is protect someone from being spoofed into thinking that a machine on their local LAN, which may or may not be trusted,
mm-hmm.
is actually a machine not on the local LAN, but some devious site out on the net.
Right.
But that certainly doesn't protect the bigger problem of any legitimate user out on the net connecting to your system.
Do you think CERT has been forthcoming in the hazards here?
That I couldn't tell you, since I never read CERT advisories anyway, because they're always long and useless.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good evening. You're on the radio.
Yeah. Are you familiar with a phenomenon called vote scam?
Vote scam?
Vote scam.
Well, why don't you tell us about it?
It's the title of a book by two brothers who said they're aware of certain kinds of tampering in Florida, like 25 years ago and more, and where through electronics and computer, entire, you know, votes were stolen because...
25 years ago?
Yeah.
There was electronic voting 25 years ago?
Well, there's been... I'm sorry. There was vote tampering, but the electronic type is more recent. And in fact, in the Times of Wednesday... today is Wednesday. I guess it was Monday.
Uh-huh.
The same day that you saw the article having to do with Internet, there was an article on the op-ed page about introducing a computer vote recording in New York, and they talk about how that is so easily tampered with. And I don't know that it's not already in existence in some other cities. Are you aware of anything like that at all?
I'm not aware of it per se. Of course, tampering with votes is certainly something that you have to accept the possibility of.
Well, according to them, it's been something that, if it's not just electronic and computer, it's been going on. Well, we know that does exist on a fairly wide scale, and they have some various exposés. But now they say that it is going on through computers, and that election results are being stolen.
Well. Now, let's mix these two stories together, right, we're talking about here today, where we're moving moving elections onto computers, and we're talking about how it's possible now on the Internet to masquerade as virtually anybody you choose to. And you can see there's a bit of a danger in moving too fast on that.
Did either of you happen to read that op-ed article on Monday's
Times? I didn't see it myself, no.
Yeah, well, it was quite it was almost half a page.
Uh-huh.
And it's something that's being contemplated being instituted in New York City. I don't know if there's an actual track record among other cities that has actually happened, that they've instituted this thing in other cities, but according to these brothers, it's the brothers who wrote the book, that is fairly widespread.
Mm-hmm. You see, how do you prove something like that when the vote is supposed to be anonymous to start with?
Well,
what do you check against?
Let me see. The polls are very far off, for instance, from the actual voting results.
Uh-huh.
And then, I'm quoting Michael Parenti. Are you familiar with Dr. Michael Parenti? He's a sort of a regular on WBAI.
Yeah.
Yes,
I've heard him.
Well, he's the one who mentioned it about 2 weeks ago, and I got a hold of this book called Vote Scam.
Uh-huh.
And he said that it's almost unprecedented history for so many Republicans who have gotten, reelected. There are so many incumbent Republicans who have gotten elected, no matter what kind of landslide.
Yeah, but that implies that Republicans have a handle on technology, which I don't think is anything near the truth.
Their turn. This is, who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know who it was this time, but I think it's something that should be looked into. Anyhow, the book is called Vote Scam. One word: VoteScam. The authors are Ken and Jim Collier, Collier, and the publishers are Victoria Press.
Okay.
New York City.
Oh, thanks for the information. Something to definitely think about.
Okay.
Okay, take care. I don't know. What do you think, Fiber?
Well, I'm not allowed to vote, but if I was, I think I'd be concerned.
Now, what's the deal with that? I've read in various newspapers and magazines that you're not allowed to ever vote again, or is it just while you're on probation?
For my duration of being on probation, which is the next 3 years.
Next 3 years. So you won't have a say in whether Clinton gets a second go-around.
No. Well, then again, I've never voted even when I could.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I never was quite interested in voting.
Uh-huh. Well, there are a lot of fine choices out there. Unfortunately, most of them aren't running. But that's just the nature of it. A lot of press recently in the last couple of weeks. What's going on here? I see your face and name everywhere. Time, Newsweek, New York, Newsday, New York Times.
Back 40.
Yeah, yeah. That was an interesting time we had a couple of weeks ago. I haven't had a chance to talk about it.
Yeah, actually, it was lots of fun, except for the initial paparazzi.
Uh-huh.
Lots of really obnoxious cameramen.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we spent a lot of the time just running away from the media. I was a lot more successful because I was able to stay out of their sites completely.
Yeah.
Although I did, at one point, just open up a laptop to see if they'd crowd around, and sure enough, without even asking permission, they were filming the screen.
Right.
And, of course, when they saw what the screen said, I guess they couldn't air that over the TV. But that's one way around it. Where was all... What I'm tempted to ask is, where were all the media people when you were going away? You know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Back in January. Yeah, well, I don't know. They didn't seem to really care that much. I think you said it pretty well in New York. What was that line you had?
They wanted to make me look like scum when I got indicted. Now they all want to be my friend.
Right, right. It's kind of weird how it works. So that's the media for you. But at least it's good news that they're reporting now and fun times and things like that.
Yeah, really.
Boy, but yeah, that was a madhouse there.
Yeah, it definitely was.
Yeah, you know, also, I got to say this. We had the thing at Irving Plaza. And, you know, I swore that when I got back out of Irving Plaza, I would tell people about this. Do you know they have payphones inside that place that charge you to call 800 numbers?
It wouldn't surprise me.
And the thing is, you know, most of us can't get to those payphones because you have to pay to get in the first place. But, yeah, they charge you, I think, it's either 25 or 75 cents to call an 800 number. And then on top of that, they turn off your touch tones. So, problem is, I can't find out the payphone numbers, otherwise I'd report them. So I have to somehow figure out how to get in there and get those payphone numbers.
Hmm.
Someone at Irving Plaza is listening. Please give us a call and tell us what your payphone numbers are. Do us a favor there. Thanks. 212-279-3400. The program is Off the Hook. Good evening. You're on the radio.
Yes, hi. I can ask the guy a question.
Well, speak up.
Hey, I'm sorry. The guy who's doing the radio right now for computers and...
Go ahead, you're on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm a first-time user.
Uh-huh.
Let me turn this radio off here.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. Turn the radio down. Oh.
Okay, yes, hi.
Hi.
First-time user in computers, and I'd like to know, and ask maybe Fiber, he can ask me that, answer this question, what kind of material should I be reading and to understand, in and outs of computers?
Well, I don't know. It could be a little bit more general.
Basically working with the,
I was joking, but go ahead, Fiber.
Oh, me?
Yeah, go ahead, answer this question.
The internet, and, earlier you were talking about the spoofs and that kind of, lingo.
Well, you're not interested in spoofing, I hope.
No, I'm not.
Because if you were, we'd have to tell you, not to talk to us about that. Some sleazier radio program might deal with that kind of issue, but, we're here to tell you how not to be spoofed.
Right.
Not how to spoof.
Now, I try to listen to your radio program every time I go to work, and I find it interesting to have some kind of information like this on radio. Maybe you can just give me some more detail and understanding more of computers.
Well, Fiber, where would you send them?
Well, I hate to say it, but there's no one-stop shopping for spoof sniffers and things that go bump in the night. I mean, it's not something written about in books.
I see.
Are you interested in just general knowledge of computers, period?
Well, yeah, but, good information for first-time beginners.
Well, what kind of system are you using?
I'm using a brand name. It's the, Compact Viserio.
Uh-huh.
And, it's pretty good, sometimes I get stuck on certain things and, trying to read regarding DOS and stuff like that. It's the books that they come with, it's kind of profound.
Well, no, you don't want to read those manuals. They generally are terrible. What I would suggest is go to a bookstore and go to the computer section. You'll see all kinds of they have a series, you know, whatever for dummies. Not that you're a dummy, but that's just what they call them, and they're kind of easy to understand, and they have a good sense of humor, and they talk about various things. That might be what you're looking for.
Well, when is Fiber going to write a book?
When am I going to write a book? Well, the story's still going.
That's right. When the story is over, that's when you write the book.
Yeah.
I see.
We're about
okay,
up to chapter
you.
3 now, I think.
Yeah, the story might never end, though.
That's true. It might be a never-ending story, and in which case, I don't know. We'll need a team of writers to write the book.
Get a book contract and just write a page every so often.
Yeah.
Publish a page.
Well, get a page contract. There you go.
That might work.
I wonder if you can do that. Just write a page now and then and release that. A lot easier to carry, you know?
Yeah.
Good evening. You're on the radio. Hello? I think they fell asleep. Okay, let's try this one. Good evening. You're on the radio.
Well?
Yes, go ahead.
First off, I'd like to compliment you on your music.
Thanks, but you'll need to speak up.
Oh, sorry.
That's better.
I'd like some general information on where to start some periodicals or some books on hacking.
Okay, another beginner here. Well, you're interested in beginning hacking, is that right?
Yes.
Are you on the net?
I'm on America Online.
You're on America Online. My condolences. Where are you located?
On Long Island.
You're on Long Island? Where on Long Island? Nassau or Suffolk?
Nassau.
I think Panix has local dial-ups in Nassau County. Does Echo, Mark? Mark, you there?
Yeah.
Oh. You don't need to scream. Does Echo have local dial-ups in
Nassau? Oh, yes, we do.
In Nassau County?
No.
Well, okay. Never mind then. As far as I know, Panix is the only system. And there's also something called LINet, which
LI.net.
I think... Yeah, they're in Suffolk County. They might have something in Nassau. You might want to contact them as well. But that's real internet access, you see.
I have access to internet from my friend's account, but...
Uh-huh.
I have it, though.
Well, you know, you can also go in through a school. Is that what you're referring to?
School?
Yeah, you know, if your friend has a school account, you can access the internet from there.
A university.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Okay. Well, that's one way of doing it. But you just want more information on hacking. Well, you know, if you're on the net, obviously, if you get on some news groups, that's one way of finding out. Of course, you have to realize that maybe 1 in 10 answers there is serious to any question that you might ask. There's also various sites. I don't have any of them handy right now, but you know, sites where you can get hacking documentation and things like that. We'll be putting up a site pretty soon in the next month or so at 2600. So that's one thing. You can also read hard copy. Go back down to a bookstore like we told the other caller, and try that.
I've been reading the latest Wired and the latest 2600.
Uh huh.
Gonna subscribe to the 2600 sometime soon. So. That'll help, I guess.
Well, that should help. That'll at least get you, you know, started in some ways. But you have to remember, the hacker world is huge.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of different things going on all the time. Okay? You're fading fast, so I'm going to let you go. Boy, I don't know what it is with the phone lines tonight, Fiber.
What about them?
I don't know. You're very loud, and they're very low. I don't quite know why that is.
You still have the feedback line?
No, the feedback line has been disconnected. We now have just a regular line in its place. Pretty wild here. Okay, let's go to another phone call. Good evening, you're on.
Yeah, I was wondering what you think of the first class BBSs. Are you familiar with that?
First class BBSs. Tell us what that is. Hello.
Yeah. Well, you make fun of America Online. This is sort of like an alternative to that. It gives you the graphical interface, but you know you can do two things at different times and so on and. There's one right here in New York. It's called New York Online.
Okay.
Do you know that one?
I've heard of that. I've never used it myself.
It's really cool. I mean, the best thing about it is that it's first class. I was wondering if there were any others here in New York.
I'm not sure what you mean by first class.
First class is it's a software. It's the software that runs it.
Okay.
So it isn't just that one. I mean, like America Online has their own software. Which is lousy, but this one it will allow, like
It will allow you to open up your mailbox, read your messages. While you're reading your messages, you might be able to you'll be able to chat, and that's
attached to New York Online.
What's that again?
That's attached to New York Online.
No, New York Online is just one of them. There must be hundreds of them, because the software is available to anybody who will want to set up a BBS.
Mm-hmm. How does one get the software?
I don't know. You probably have to buy it or get a license for it or something. But it's probably not. It's probably on the level of shareware.
Uh-huh.
Now, again, the only thing you have to do is have the hardware to take advantage of it and set up your own BBS.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mark, have you had any dealings with first class?
I've never heard of it.
Never heard of it either. Okay.
First class?
All right. Well, we'll look into it.
It's cool.
Let me think about it.
Okay, you take care.
All right, thanks for calling. All right, let's take another phone call. Good evening, you're on.
Oh, yes, hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
A couple of questions. The simpler one first. Concerning caller ID.
Yeah.
Recently, my wife received, a pretty abusive phone call, and so we're considering getting caller ID. But when I took a look at it with the phone company, they explained that, if somebody wants to block it, they'll just block it. So I guess I could capture the stupid callers.
Right.
Somebody that was planning to do it, I wouldn't be able to get the information.
It also depends on where they're calling from. Do you suspect they're calling locally or from some other part of the country?
Well, I just don't really know,
See, what you have to understand is there's always a way, if the person is halfway intelligent, there's always going to be a way of blocking the number from going through. They can call through an operator, they can call through another long-distance company, they can call through a PBX someplace, they can call from a payphone. You'll only catch someone who's rather stupid in that particular method. However, there is something that has always been available. You don't have to pay for it. It's when you get an abusive phone call, you just simply call the New York Telephone Annoyance Call Bureau, and they will deal with it. They have to deal with it.
And because I was thinking that in the whole computer system of phone calling,
mm-hmm.
It's everything is probably tagged and available at some level.
Right. If you put a what's known as a trap and trace on your line, or actually just a trap, you tell them when the abusive call came in, and they will be able to find out who made that phone call. They won't tell you who did it, though. They never tell you that.
Uh-huh.
But they will do something about it. They'll contact that person, and they'll tell them to stop calling you. Of course, that might not be what you want.
Yeah.
But that's really how it works.
Information is available to them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Okay, well, thank you on that. And then the other question I had, on this whole information highway that everybody's getting linked into now, and then more and more information is pouring through in all different directions, what is there technically to prevent governments and corporations to jump in between you and your information source and distort it or change it or modify it? In other words, you could do fantastic manipulations with people this way.
Well, I think the best thing we have on our side is our sheer numbers, the fact that there are so many of us, and we understand the system so much better than they do. Right now, it's not really an information superhighway. It's like an information parking lot.
Right.
And some of us are driving around at high speeds and circles and making it dangerous for the rest of us. But it's awfully hard to block off a parking lot, once you're already inside it. I'm going to stop with that analogy now. But basically, I don't think they have enough of a handle on it to be able to manipulate it very effectively. If they had a handle on it before it even began, say, 20, 25 years ago, we'd be looking at a very, very different scenario now, because they would have foreseen the importance of all of this. But really, it's too late for that kind of manipulation unless we completely give up all control that we have now.
Oh, really? So you don't think, just letting your conspiracy theory part of your brain...
Mm-hmm.
Because I assume they have very large and powerful computers, and if they keep coming to your meetings and start recruiting some of your people, maybe they'll have some real brain power to put behind it.
Have you ever tried to recruit a hacker? It's not the easiest thing in the world to do.
No, but they, well...
They keep asking these inconvenient questions and things like that, but no, I see your point.
Yeah.
I just think that there are enough of us to constantly be questioning and providing alternative sources of information, but we have to remain vigilant, obviously. There's no reason to become complacent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you for that.
All right.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thanks for calling. Fiber, do you agree with what I said?
Yeah. I think it'd be kind of hard. I mean, where was he coming from? Does he think that they're just going to brainwash hackers and sort of keep them in a fish tank or something?
Well, no, I think maybe he thinks that everyone's going to be brainwashed at some point, or just at least manipulated or controlled or kind of curled into a corner or something. I don't know. It's a fear that is running rampant among the net today, because people see, you know, the government getting interested in controlling, interested in encryption, all that kind of thing, and you know, they generally get what they want. The United States government is a pretty darn powerful government, you know? So when they express an interest in something, they usually get it. So is this something that's going to be an exception?
Yeah. I'm sure they don't like that very much either.
No, they don't. They don't. I'm sure they don't like being mocked on the air either, so we're going to stop now. besides, it's time for us to go on to another program. Fiber, best of luck down at Echo. I hope things work out over there.
Thanks. This upgrade. Let me give a word of advice to everyone listening.
Go ahead.
Don't buy an operating system that's maintained by Mormons.
Okay. Why would we do that in the first place?
Well, I don't want to name names, but in this case, I have to. Ever since AT&T Unix stopped being AT&T Unix, and now it's Novell Unix, it's been nothing but a nightmare.
Now, where did the Mormons come into this?
Because Novell is in Utah, and Novell is a Mormon company.
Novell is... Well, you know, I run Novell DOS. Does that mean I'm running...
Well, Novell DOS is another one of those things. It's not really from Novell. It was kind of bought over from Digital Research since Gary Kildall died.
Uh-huh.
Sort of untimely. But,
Or was it untimely?
It
oh,
was
sorry, that was the conspiracy part of my brain kicking in. Okay, we better stop this now. But we'll be back. Hopefully we'll be back next week, and we'll go into more detail on this. Fiber, thanks again, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay.
And that's going to do it for us here. Another exciting edition of Off the Hook is History. We'll be back again next week from 10 to 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Pacifica special, 100 Days of Congress. This is WBAI in New York. Again, thanks everybody for bringing in that fantastic total. $820,000 for our last marathon. A world record, I believe, and something that will help keep this radio station strong. Again, if you pledge, please remember to pay your pledge. Thanks again. See you next week.
Welcome to Pacifica National Programs, 100 Days of Congress, with your hosts, Julian Malvo and Larry Binsky.
I came to this hallowed chamber 2 years ago on a mission to restore the American dream for all our people and to make sure that we move into the 21st century still the strongest force for freedom and democracy in the entire world. I was determined then to tackle the tough problems too long ignored. In this effort, I am frank to say that I have made my mistakes, and I have learned again the importance of humility in all human endeavor. But I am also proud to say tonight that our country is stronger than it was 2 years ago.
Good morning. Welcome to the Pacifica 100 Days of Congress special. I'm Julian Malvo with co-host Larry Binsky. And Larry, yesterday, Bill Clinton learned humility yet again. An hour and 20 minutes of history lesson, humility. You were here for Pacifica doing live coverage of the speech. What did you think?
Well, I thought, first of all, that all the pundits and people who write books about what an undisciplined mind he has and how difficult it is for him to come to the point are absolutely right. You could hear the sound of televisions and radios clicking off all over the United States. I think in that sense, he really blew an opportunity to communicate in a concise manner. And also, Julianne, throughout the speech, I kept hearing hints of programs and hints of taking a stand, but when you boil it down to find out what he really drew the line at, you come to very few
things. He drew the line at teen pregnancy. The worst thing that is happening in the world today is teen pregnancy. I mean, it seems to me, I sat at home and with my laptop in my lap, hoping to make some notes, but every time he just about got to a thought, my fingers got over the keyboard, then he moved on, and so it was really too late. But the three things that I remember some emphasis about, and it really disturbs me about two of those three things. One was the crackdown on illegal immigration. The other was teen pregnancy. And, of course, the increasing of the minimum wage, which I absolutely support, but feel that, you know, this is something we would have liked to hear him ask the 103rd Congress for. He doesn't have the votes for it.
The other two things that I heard him really get very close to taking a stand on, actually taking a strong stand on, one was the repeal of the Brady Bill. He basically said he's going to veto it.
He did take a very strong nail on that.
He's going to veto that if Congress brings that to his attention in form of legislation. The other thing was about campaign finance reform and the whole question of Washington corruption. He urged everybody in the chamber to just say no to lobbyist donations. Well, that sounds very good as a soundbite, but that isn't the way business is done in this town. You got 15,000 men and women running around up there with satchels full of money, ready to buy politicians. And for everybody in the audience to stand up for a standing ovation when he said, just say no to lobbyists, and then turn around probably the same night
and
go out
to dinner with
lobbyists,
yeah,
is the height of the kind of hypocrisy that people hate about Washington.
And in addition, I mean, the Democratic National Committee isn't exactly going to be turning lobbyist funds away. And as the titular head of the Democratic Party, it seems to me that while the president had a good applause line, there's nothing that he is practically going to do to stop the Democratic Party from getting that money.
True enough. Joining us now to discuss this and share in this conversation this morning on Pacifica's 100 Days are Clarence Lussain. Clarence, are you with us?
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, Clarence.
Clarence Lussain, an expert in black politics, especially in Washington, and editor of a very fine newsletter on that topic. And as well, we're joined by Saul Landau, who's a commentator for Pacifica Radio and a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm here.
Clarence, let's start with you. You listened to the hour and 20 minutes. I don't mean to belabor that point, but I think when I look at Larry's eyes being held up by toothpicks because he sat here and covered it live. As you listen, Clarence, what were your thoughts?
Well, my usual opinion when I listen to Clinton's speeches are manic depression. You know, what you tend to get is several different things, Clinton going to the left and the right at the same time. And that's what we got last night. When I watched the speech, and I'm not sure what other people saw on their television, but it looked to me like sometimes Clinton would turn into the Clinton of 1992 and the campaign themes of we got to change America and take it back from this conservative trend. And then other times he would kind of morph into Bush and sometimes even into Ronald Reagan. I think you're absolutely right, Julianne. This whole thing about illegal immigrants, which I heard very few commentators mention, was some of the worst comments I've heard coming from anybody in years. He literally, almost, I was expecting him to say he was going to go to the border himself and grab some Mexicans and drag them back across the border. That's how terrible it was.
Wait for the election. You may actually see that.
Yeah, I can imagine the pictures. So I thought that, you know, again, it was, you know, it was very scattered kind of speech that was kind of all over the map and had little focus. And this was the opportunity. When I think, particularly given the tone of Congress right now, where you had to pretty much throw down the gauntlet and draw the lines, you know, in every way possible. And in fact, I think very consciously he went to blur the lines. And except for the couple of instances that you all noted, he did.
Saul?
Well, I think that really you guys are being much too hard on the president. That I think by 1996, first of all, medical science will have a way to solve the problems that you see every time he appears in public. I think by that time, the character transplant will be a perfected operation, and he'll be fine.
Well, your medical optimism, Saul, is always appreciated, but given the fact that this will be a high-tech operation that only President Clinton can afford, what does that say for the rest of us?
Well, I think the rest of us are in the stew no matter what happens. I think what we saw last night was, I would say, pathetic. You know, my teenage kid sometimes says NYPD is preempted for this, right? and she was outraged. She says, Jesus, he's boring. I try to say, well, no, listen to it, you know, because you're president and all that, but I didn't convince her. Anyway, it seemed to me that the Clinton speech comes as a result of the same kind of process that a lot of the Clinton legislation comes from, that you have a big seminar, and everybody gets a little part. So you have various speech writers, and you say, take paragraph one from so-and-so, take paragraph two from this one, and so on. So you start with the Bill of Rights, with the Declaration of Independence, right? the inalienable rights. And within 30 seconds, he's up to the Schmagegis, Truman and Reagan, the two stupidest presidents we've probably had in the last 50 years. And he puts them all, he lumps them all into one grouping, and then he talks about essentially the revival of the American dream. And this was going to be his pitch. How do you revive the American dream? What the hell is this dream at this point? Does anybody ask Americans, first of all, what's your dream? Right? People say, I don't know, I can't remember my dream. You know, I was sleeping last night, but I only remember pieces of it, but it wasn't so good. What is the American dream? I mean, Martin Luther King was the only person that I can think of who articulated what the American dream was. And it was a vision of people living in equality, racial equality, economic equality. And this has nothing to do with what Bill Clinton was talking about. So you have these high-sounding words like the democracy and freedom extending, blah, blah, blah. And then when you come down to it, is I'm going to cut your taxes more than they. We're going to see the government doesn't interfere. It's all petty, all banal, with an attack on immigrants. Don't worry, we're not going to let these foreigners foul up our soil any more than they have, and so on.
Let me see if we can get to a point that not too many people have focused on yet here. The one that kind of caught me up short a little bit towards the end of the speech, where he talked about violence on television and said while he supports the freedom of expression for people in Hollywood, that they have a responsibility to assess the impact of their work. And this is a time when everybody in the House and Senate just got to their feet, which, by the way, didn't happen all that often. A lot of the times the Republicans were sitting, the Democrats were standing up and applauding. These are some of his major campaign contribution people.
Yeah, but he didn't see, didn't you see The Player, Larry?
Yes, the movie.
And the relevance thereof?
Well, I mean, here, The Player presented, I thought, the reality of Hollywood, but sort of underplayed it. And here he's asking these people to make sacrifices, to move forward with freedoms, to exert more responsibility. If the people who ran Hollywood exerted more responsibility, the culture would be even more trivial, banal, and stupid than it is.
Oh, my goodness. Saul, you really seem pretty cynical and bitter this morning. What's on your nerves?
Well, I was in Hollywood last week, Julianne. What can I tell you? You you think you've hit the bottom, and then you meet people who are essentially in charge of the entertainment industry, and their only value is making more money.
Clarence, violence is something that in the African-American community we've had a lot of discussion about, because obviously violence hits our community most hard. What did you think when you heard the president through that piece at the end of the speech?
Well, you know, maybe this is my paranoia, but I thought it was a veiled attack on rap music. That was the first thing that kind of came to my mind. And, you know, it comes after he talks about terrorism and raising the military budget, $25 billion and all of that. Then he goes into this thing about the attack on the entertainment industry and then teen pregnancy. So that seemed to me to be kind of tag-ons to say, oh, and about these black teenagers, by the way. So that was my spin on it. But, you know, the thing is that these speeches have become, farcical. You know, and they become just kind of literal comedies at a certain point. I think Larry made the point last night that there was something like 70 standing ovations. I mean, that's, you know, Michael Jackson doesn't get that many at his performances in Budapest somewhere. But, you know, so it becomes kind of a theater of the absurd, and the reality becomes these speeches are only kind of marking more what will not happen in Congress than they are what will happen.
Well, one thing that President Clinton emphasized again was his new covenant, which we haven't heard about since the election, and also the so-called middle-class Bill of Rights. And I'd like to get your take, each of you, on the middle-class Bill of Rights. In fact, he's off to Kutztown, Pennsylvania today to talk about that at the grassroots level. Is this more pre-electoral hype, or is there something in there that you think is going to emerge as significant legislation?
Well, I don't see we have a Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights is a middle-class Bill of Rights. It protects people's, what are those freedoms that are defined in the Declaration of independence, the inalienable rights. But what Clinton's telling us, you got a right to a tax cut this year or next year, or do you have a right to a tax cut every year? So by the time you get into the 21st century, the government will have no right to collect taxes anymore. What? I don't understand what this means, that the people who already have something should be allowed to keep at least what they have and accumulate a little more. Is that what it means? What is the middle class? Where does it start? At 30,000, 50,000, 100,000? Well, it's so vague. It's so silly. It is the, how should I say it? It's the era in which somebody gets a good slogan saying, middle class. We got to do something for the middle class. Whoever they are, they're the 17 or 18% of the American population that elected this last Congress. I think that's somebody said that's so the actual percentage of eligible voters.
It's the spoils of victory. Well, Clarence, what about the middle class tax cut?
Well, I think Clinton's in trouble on it from a number of vantage points. One, a lot of Democrats on the Hill are going to oppose it. Certainly most of the members, if not all of the congressional that are in the Congressional Black Caucus, are going to oppose tax cuts. But also you've got a lot of liberal members who are going to oppose. I would say probably at least half of the Democrats up there just off the top are not going to go with it. But even within Clinton's administration, there are people who are going to oppose it. Last night when he got to that point in the speech, the channel that I was watching cut to Robert Reich, who not only did not stand up, but had a look on his face like he just stepped in some dog poo. he was absolutely opposed to it in terms of his gestures and his expression.
Well,
we're
going to come right back and talk about tax cuts with an excerpt from Christine Todd Whitman, whose big theme this is. Thank you very much, Saul Landau and Clarence Lussain, for being with us on 100 Days. The response to President Clinton's State of the Union address last night was given by New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who has become a kind of poster girl for the tax-cutting new Republican majority in Congress and in many state legislatures around the country. Christine Todd Whitman has promised and, according to many people, delivered promises of tax cutting in New Jersey. She gave a much briefer response than President Clinton's speech, and a great deal of it was about the tax issue.
In the first year, with the help of the New Jersey legislature, we cut business taxes. We reduced income taxes not once, but twice. We lowered state spending, not recklessly, but carefully and fairly. Just yesterday, I announced a third wave of income tax cuts, another 15%, taking us to a 30% reduction, to put more money in the hands of families like yours. The results have been solid. State revenues are up, even from the income tax, and 60,000 more New Jerseyans are at work today than were a year ago, making this year our best year for job creation since 1988. And we did it all under a balanced budget requirement to our state's constitution. In November, the revolution came to Washington. Now people want less government, lower taxes, and less spending from their federal government. People want results. In both houses of Congress, the Republican Party has been elected, like many of us in the states were, on an agenda. Reforming welfare, to encourage people to work and to stop children from having children. We want to force the government to live within its means, by stopping runaway spending and balancing the federal budget. We want to lower taxes for families and make it easier to achieve the American dream, to save money, buy a home, and send the kids to college. We're going to stop violent criminals in their tracks with real prison time for repeat offenders and a workable death penalty. We must send a message to our young people that crime doesn't pay. And we're going to slash those unnecessary regulations that strangle small business in America to make it easier to create more jobs and pay better wages and become more competitive in the global marketplace. We intend to create a new era of hope and opportunity for all Americans. Many of these ideas are the same ones governors have been enacting here in the States. Time after time, Republicans and Democrats have found that things work better when states and communities set their own priorities rather than being bossed around by bureaucrats in Washington. Our colleagues in Capitol Hill are facing the same opposition we did, the same cries of it can't be done from the Washington's knows best crowd, people who think government can't be too big and that there's a virtue in raising taxes. Well, there is nothing virtuous about raising taxes. There is nothing heroic about preserving a welfare system that entraps people. And there's nothing high-minded about wasting other people's money on big government spending sprees. We overcame the same objections, the same stalling and distortion, the same foot-dragging. We've heard it all. And in the end, we have won the battle of ideas in our states. Now it's time to win the battle of ideas in Washington.
We're back on Pacifica's 100 Days of Congress special. I'm Julianne Malvo with co-host Larry Binsky, and we're joined by Doug Hinwood, editor of the Left Business Report. Doug, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You heard Christine Todd Whitman talk about no glory in increasing taxes and challenging the president to cut taxes. What do you think?
Yeah, it's amazing that they call these new ideas. I mean, these are pretty old things, and to call them ideas is to glorify them a lot. I mean, it's as if American politics has been reduced to who can cut taxes more. I mean, the whole it's just gimmickry. I mean, the idea of serious discussion about what government is supposed to do and how it's supposed to do it is completely marginalized, and it's all just I want to cut your taxes. Government stinks. You know, it's kind of a Beavis and Butthead approach to taxes. Government sucks. Tax cuts good. You know, that's about the extent of it.
Doug, the New York Times yesterday had an article about the effect and the nature of what Governor Whitman is doing in New Jersey, and I wonder, as somebody who lives in New York, if you could go into that a little bit. Among other things, it shows how what she's doing is really going to hit poor people hard. One thing that caught me is you used to be able to take supermarket coupons, you know, that you get in the newspaper to the supermarket, mm-hmm. and if you got a quarter off on a dollar purchase, you'd be taxed only on the 75 cents you paid. Now, according to Governor Whitman, you're taxed on the whole dollar. Now, this is the kind of petty thing that hits poor people, nickel and diming poor people to make up for their middle-class income tax cuts.
Well, maybe a big bite on poor folks, but that kind of thing is not going to make up much for the loss of revenue in the big picture. The first phase of her tax cut, which happened last year, was financed rather painlessly through some pension fund gimmicks. They recalculated the formula at which the state contributes to the employee pension funds.
Well, stop 1 minute there. What's going to happen to the people who try to get those pensions in 20 or 30
years? Well,
that's
a good question. It may be that it's entirely prudent. It may be that it's excessively optimistic. And it may be that 10 years from now, they're going to find out that they're coming up short in the pensions, and they're going to have to do something about that. So it's either they'll have to top them up somehow through special revenues, or they'll cut the pensions. But in the short term, it's a painless way to finance something. It's something that a lot of municipalities and even a lot of companies have